Thank you, Stephen. My name is Debbie Banks, and I've been with EIA now for about 10 years, and I head up EIA's Tiger campaign. My background is in zoology, but obviously as a campaigner, we have to look at how we can fit tiger conservation into a wide range of issues, matters relating to politics, economics, the media, governance, and of course law and enforcement. At present, we are focusing our energy on the skin trade. The illegal trade in tiger and leopard skins has been spiraling out of control for the last 5 years and now poses the most severe and direct threat to the recovery of wild tiger populations. And I'd like to take this opportunity to give you a little bit of background about the issue, our approach to the problem, and our methodologies. The trafficking of tiger and leopard skins from India into Tibet and China, often through Nepal, vividly illustrates the role of organized criminal networks. These are wealthy and well-connected individuals operating out of urban and cross-border areas in the Himalayan region. And they're involved in a low-risk, high-profit venture. And it's low-risk because the governments concerned are unable or sometimes unwilling to really apply the necessary resources to stopping this trade. So when you have a situation with poor domestic enforcement and poor regional cooperation, you've got a situation where the skin dealers have the upper hand. EIA's approach to this problem has been to work with local partners to investigate and document the dynamics of the trade using the wealth of data that is out there about trafficking routes and so forth to show the need for the engagement of professional enforcement officers, its police and customs officers, because we believe only then can we really start to combat what is now widely recognized as another form of serious transnational crime. To do our work, we obviously have to ground truth the information that is out there. We go out to gather visual evidence of what's really happening on the ground, and then we'll package that information for different audiences. So I'm not sure if you'll see it in this light, but we produce concise documents like this report, which is our first report on the skin trade, the tiger skin trail. And it's not just a colorful document. It's a vital campaign tool that we've already used quite successfully to elevate the status of tiger conservation and the skin trade higher up the domestic and international agenda in order to ensure that the necessary resources and political support are assigned to the task of conserving the tiger. This report details some important characteristics about the trade as well, so it's also a useful enforcement tool that will facilitate more effective and targeted action by the enforcement community. The kinds of information in here will include things like trafficking routes and methodologies. We draw on or highlight specific examples of clues that the enforcement authorities can look for. So in this case, when tiger and leopard skins are seized in India, Nepal, and China, they're often traveling with vast quantities of otter skin, which gives a clue to the final markets. Also in this report, or in reports like this that EIA produces on other issues, we might document examples of the criminal networks that are controlling the trade. We'll highlight how valuable it is to gather information from mobile phones and diaries that are confiscated from people who are arrested, because this helps enforcement officers draw connections between people and seizures across time and across space, which can help if you've got limited resources and you need to target them more effectively. We've also used this report quite effectively in bringing about the early stages of regional cooperation, and we worked closely with the UK government at a conference of the parties of the UN Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, CITES, where we helped secure an agreement to set up the first trilateral meeting between India, Nepal, and China that allowed them to exchange intelligence on this really important issue for the first time. The preliminary findings of our work indicated that Tibet is a distribution and market point for the trade. Myself and Julian had been there in 2004 and observed local costumes decorated with skins. But we also talked to some of the traders and learned that wealthy visitors from China would, for example, buy tiger skin to take home to decorate their home. Western tourists will buy leopard skin. And one of the traders showed us how easy it was to fold up a leopard skin, put it in your suitcase between your clothes, and it'll go through the X-ray machines at the airport unnoticed. But phase two of our investigation was really to assess the scale of those different markets and try and determine which one is the primary driving force behind the trade. We undertook a further research, desk-based research, and then drew up an itinerary that would take us across Tibet and Western China for 4 weeks, where we would visit a number of the market towns in the area, but we would also attend annual horse festivals. These are locally organized events in Tibet and Western China, where nomads and villagers get together, celebrate their culture through dance and music. They race horses, trade horses, and of course it's an important opportunity for future husbands and wives to meet each other. We realized instantly that this is clearly the primary market for tiger and leopard skins. Without a doubt, the sheer scale of the market is frightening. We saw quite literally hundreds of people wearing tiger and leopard skins. Quite openly, this young fellow was happy to pose for the camera and to be interviewed. We saw tiger, leopard, and otter skins openly for sale on the street, which is illegal. And some of the dealers, the skin dealers that we met, were aware that what they were doing was illegal, were a bit more cautious, and hence the need to sometimes use hidden cameras to document our findings. I should stress that this isn't tradition in Tibet. Hundreds of years ago, Tibetan kings might reward victorious war commanders with a small patch of skin or a thin strip of skin. But what was largely confined to the political and military elite today has spread far more widely among the general population. And today what we're really seeing is fashion. It's a way of displaying family wealth. There's huge sums of money involved in buying these skins. People are prepared to pay up to $10,000 for a whole tiger skin. But we also engage quite closely with the people who are wearing and trading these skins, and learn that they're oblivious to the plight of the wild tiger. They're not aware that a wild tiger is killed in another country deliberately to acquire the skin for them to decorate a costume. So what we're looking at is a lack of enforcement and a lack of awareness. And we've addressed this using our various campaign tools. We've provided confidential briefing documents to the relevant enforcement authorities. We've briefed CITES, which has in turn prompted a greater scrutiny over enforcement policy and practice in India, Nepal, and China. And we've released our information to the media to stimulate a wider international concern. I think most people are aware that tigers are killed for their bones for traditional medicines, but far fewer people are aware of the threat posed by the skin trade. We've also made good use of our stunning images to raise awareness amongst the consumers. And I'm just about to show you a short awareness film, which obviously is targeted to a slightly different audience. It's targeted towards Kampa Tibetans, who are the primary skin wearers. So while you might not understand what's being said, I think you'll find from the images that you get the message. So this should work. Your DVD's still in there.
Thank you. 공기 손에 군지바 대나 파파 문주대 소자 깨나 미세와 파파 셰자 제바이 Jakarta, Tazi Tondra Mambo, Sechin Dola, Tini, Jopo Tesu, Chechon Haki Mare, Tazi Misepe, Runoro, Tazi Papa Magarono,
His Holiness the Dalai Lama has made several statements encouraging his fellow Tibetans not to engage in the trade and not to wear skins. And of course, unfortunately, his message can't reach or be circulated in Tibet or Western China itself. And so what we've done is produce a very simple and non-political message that's safe to distribute. It tries to appeal to the Buddhist consciousness of the people of the region. Of course, awareness alone is not going to secure a future for the wild tiger. And we will continue to press for urgent and effective enforcement action. And hopefully we'll secure that future for the wild tiger. I'm going to pass now to my colleague Julian, who's going to talk to you and describe some more of our broad undercover investigative work. So thank you very much.
Evening, everyone. My name's Julian. I've been at AIA for about 8 years. Before that, I was a journalist, including with the Express, so I guess my current work kind of atones for some previous sins. I've carried out quite a few investigations over the years, and I want to talk to you tonight about a couple of our projects that we work on. You've seen from Debbie that we do quite species-specific work, trying to protect the tiger. We also work on broader threats to the global environment, mostly in two areas. One is ozone depletion. The ozone hole over the southern hemisphere is around about 28 million square kilometers. It's about bigger than the size of North America. That has profound implications for human health and the environment. Another issue we work on is deforestation, particularly in the tropics. Again, some figures. Deforestation around the world is said to be about 13 million hectares a year, give or take a few million hectares. In the tropics, it's about 10 million hectares. Look at these problems sometimes. Look at these figures. We're talking about millions of hectares, millions of square kilometers. These problems can seem overwhelming. They can seem huge and daunting. And there's only a few of us, so what can we possibly do about these problems? What we try and do is we try and look at these problems from the ground level. We try and see the processes which are driving these environmental problems. And our speciality is to look at how illegal trade creates these problems. And how we do that is by getting close to the action, really. We get close to the traders and the brokers who are creating these problems, and we try and reveal how they're breaking the law. And that's the sort of information that we, is our stock in trade, really. Using the information, we try and catch the attention of the public and decision makers. Just got a few pictures, so I ain't got to look at me all night. Where's... Okay, so illegal logging. In Indonesia, where this picture's taken, there's around about another figure, 3 million hectares of forest are lost every year. That's a huge figure. But what does that really mean? I mean, it ultimately means a guy in a forest with a chainsaw. This picture was taken in a national park in Indonesia. Of course, logging in national parks is supposed to be banned. But in Indonesia, these sort of things are routine. What we tried to do when we started working in Indonesia in 1999 was we looked at the issue from a very local perspective. We didn't try and change the way things were done in Indonesia at that time. But we chose one national park, just one area, where the logging was out of control. And the place we chose was a park called Tanjung Puting National Park. We chose this park for a very clear reason. It was a park that has a big population of orangutans, and it was internationally known for its orangutan population. So in 1999, myself and some colleagues decided to go and have a look at this park. We'd heard from people that there was a big problem there. So we went into the park and we simply just went in there as tourists. That was another reason to choose in Tanjung Puting, is that our white faces wouldn't be amiss. So for a few days we went around the park, and this is what we saw. We saw huge amounts of logs being pulled down rivers. We just basically sat there and counted the number of logs coming down in broad daylight. This is in a national park, a well-known national park, where these sort of things are not supposed to happen. So our next stage after documenting what was happening in the park, it was quite simple to do this really, was to follow the trail. Where are these logs going to? Who's making the money out of this business? Following these log rafts down the river, we came to a sawmill. Now, there was one river system with big sawmills, and the one which we got access to was owned by a guy called Abdul Rasid. Abdul Rasid was the guy who ran the local town, really. He was the most powerful man in town, and he was making a fortune from illegal logging. We entered this sawmill by posing as investors. We contacted his company, said we were interested in investing in the logging business, and they were happy to escort us around their facilities. This is a big factory on the Arat River. These are all ramming logs, unmarked, clearly illegal. So this is 1999. At this time, this guy Rasid, we know, was making about $30 million a year just through his log trade. That was part of his business. It was all illegal. Didn't pay any taxes, no money going to the treasury in Indonesia for hospitals or schools, just going into his bank account in Singapore. So you can see by the time we entered the sawmill, we'd started to get a picture of how this trade works. It's not just a simple question of a few local people chopping down a few trees in the park. It involves big corruption and big money. But of course, the trail doesn't stop just in Indonesia. What's driving a lot of the Indonesian illegal logging is the demand for timber from around the world. So through our work in Indonesia, we started tracking the trade in this ramming timber, which is very valuable, about $1,000 a cubic meter once processed. We started following the trail so we could expose how this business was being done and how we could put a stop to it. This picture was taken in Malacca in West Malaysia. Malaysia is quite known globally as a country where there's lots of big timber companies, and there's a very aggressive policy in the world about promoting tropical timber. We spent a few days going up and down the coast, and we saw lots and lots of illegal Indonesian logs coming to Malaysia. This place is Malacca. For us, it was simple. It was a simple walk-in. Again, tourists taking pictures. Nobody really bothered. But this is quite crucial information, because it allowed us to start exposing how Malaysia was involved in this illegal logging. it wasn't simply just Indonesia. Malaysia was profiting from the chaos that was taking place in Indonesia next door. Remember about this time, 1999, 2000, Indonesia was just emerging from the dictatorship of Suharto. Lots of difficult situation for Indonesia. Very little control by the state. And Malaysia was profiting from this. It's basically taking Indonesia's illegal timber, stamping it as Malaysian, shipping it onto the international market. Through our efforts over the subsequent couple of years, we kept exposing this problem time and time again. We'd go back to this coastline. Malacca was closed down a year after this picture was taken. The boats a little bit up, so we found that quite easily, where these boats were coming in. And again, we exposed it using the BBC to carry a report. And after a few bouts of us continually exposing what Malaysia was up to, the Malaysian government changed its policy on imports of timber from Indonesia. So they banned Indonesian logs. It's a good example of where strong evidence goes a long way. Malaysia has been very powerful internationally at promoting tropical timber against controls to make the industry more accountable, but they can't really say much when confronted with this type of evidence. But again, looking at this, you see small wooden boats, you probably think, yeah, it's a bit of a fuss over nothing, it's not that big a deal. But to give you an idea about how big this trade is, these ships are also carrying timber out of Indonesia. You can't really call it smuggling because it's a huge vessel. This ship was stopped off the coast of Tanjung Puting, 2001, carrying a lot of Meranti logs, thousands of cubic meters. The timber on board was owned by our friend Mr. Rasid. So, again, we had good evidence. We had all the shipping documents that showed his involvement in this case. We tried to get the authorities to do something. At that time in Indonesia, again, it was quite difficult to get any action. We've been, for about 2 or 3 years, trying to pressure the government to do something about Tanjung Puting. We had some success, but obviously this trade was still going on. But this case, which we called the Three Ships case, because there were two more ships just like this, was quite an important moment, because for the first time, the Indonesian authorities actually made a major seizure of timber. Of course, things are never that easy, and our hopes that this case would lead to Mr. Rasid being prosecuted. By this time, he was a member of the parliament. It didn't come to fruition because he paid the police to halt the inquiry. The police officer, the police detective who issued the SP3 letter, which is a notice to terminate a case, said there was no case to answer because at the time of seizure, the vessel had been at anchor. Therefore, it couldn't be said to be transporting logs. You know, a bit of a weak argument there, but anyway. That police officer has recently been arrested for corruption in Indonesia, so I think it's come around in circles eventually. This vessel was interesting as well because it showed a major new trend in illegal logging and the trade in illegal timber, and that was the emergence of China as a major destination for illegal logs. The three ships that were seized in 2001 were heading towards China. So let's go back to the forest. This picture was taken in 2003 in the province of Papua in Indonesia, the Indonesian side of the island New Guinea. New Guinea has the last really, really good forest in Asia Pacific. It's the last really intact forest. When I first went to Indonesia, I flew over Kalimantan, Borneo, and it was a mess. Huge areas cleared, fire taking place, plantations. So we felt very much in Sumatra and Kalimantan in Indonesia that we were sort of firefighting really, trying to hold the line against illegal logging. In Papua in 2003, we felt we got there in time because when we flew over, good forest. But it wasn't quite that simple because underneath that canopy, illegal logging problem was spreading quickly. Our approach to Papua was to go in quite cautiously. People know about the history of Papua. It's just not an easy place to work. And we went in quietly into a place called Sorong, which is on the tip of the Bird's Head of Papua. And through making some local contacts, we got invited to go to quite a remote area where there was people called the Kunasaimos people. They wanted to come and show us what was happening to their land. And what was happening was logging without their consent, without their permission. Basically, their forests were being invaded by loggers. And the guy behind it was a local military policeman who would go in the village with his gun on, intimidate the villagers, make sure they don't really complain about this. So you look at these logs and you think, yeah, it's a bit of forest still there, there's a pile of logs, but how does this link into the international market? Well, just one more figure. People say illegal logging, the value of it is around about $15 billion a year. It's just a figure, but it gives you an idea about the scale of this problem. And this is where the logs are going to. So when we first went into Papua, we simply kept a low profile, managed to get to the forest, managed to get some useful footage, some testimonies from local people about who was behind it, how the logging was being carried out. But of course, that's not enough, really. We need to show culpability beyond Indonesia and lay the blame at the feet of the people who are consuming this timber. So for a couple of years, myself and my colleagues, we went about looking at timber species called murbau. Murbau is used a lot in flooring. And from Indonesia, from Papua, we followed the trail to Jakarta, where brokers would offer security to get the shipments out from Papua. From there, we went to Singapore. Singapore is a hub for traders, middlemen, shipping companies who sit there in the nice air-conditioned climes of Singapore, where they make vast amounts of money out of stealing Indonesia's timber. Singapore, travelers to Hong Kong. Again, the same picture, brokers, middlemen, all facilitating this trade. And after Hong Kong, we ended up in this place, quite a dismal place, which is called Jiangjigang Port near Shanghai. We went into Shanghai posing as timber buyers. And of course, that allowed us to get close to the traders, and the traders thinking that we were interested in buying huge amounts of flooring would speak quite freely about how they did the business. This is all very useful evidence for us. Caught a lot of this on undercover tape. And we actually got one of these traders to arrange for us to have a tour around this port. This port is a huge area. I mean, I can't describe the size of it, the number of logs in it. It's probably the biggest port for tropical logs in the world. A few years ago, it wasn't like this. 4 or 5 years ago, not on this scale at all. China's consumption of timber has more than doubled in 5 years. It's around about 120 million cubic meters now. So log imports have gone up by 5 times. So through our work from Papua, following the trail, we'd stumbled across a major factor in the illegal logging story, if you like. After the port, of course, timber goes somewhere else. This is a flooring factory in a town called Nanshun. Nanshun is about 2 hours away from Shanghai. A few years ago, Nanshun had about 4 or 5 flooring factories. When we got there, it had about 200. 200 flooring factories, vast majority based on murbau, vast majority of that murbau stolen from Indonesia. A huge illicit trade worth billions of dollars a year. Communities in Papua are being paid about $11 for a cubic meter of wood. If you get that timber into the port we just saw, Jiangjigang, worth about $240 a cubic meter, big profit. If you turn that log into flooring and sell it to Europe or the US, it's getting close to $2,000 a cubic meter. So we're doing this work, we're starting to piece together how this trade works. How do they get these logs from Papua into the international market? Who's doing it? What paperwork do they use? How do they evade detection? How do they get past the Navy and these sorts of things? So through our approach of tackling the issue at the ground level, getting close to the action, managed to infiltrate the companies behind it, we can build up a very, very strong story. And we also bring to this understanding of how we can counter this industry. If we know how the people are doing it, we know the tricks they're using, we can try and stop it happening by advising enforcement authorities to do something about it. Okay, so just to update you briefly, since we launched a report on that whole murbau question in 2005, and It was met with quite an instant response. The president's office asked for a copy. That was the new president at that time in Indonesia. Still is a new president. President Yudhoyono. He came to power on an anti-corruption ticket. He's also an ex-military man. So when we released a report in Jakarta stating that this illegal logging was due to corruption and military and police involvement, he felt he had to do something about it. So he dispatched an enforcement team to Papua, and there was a big effort to stop the illegal logging at the source in Indonesia, which is a significant change. We've been working in Indonesia since 1999, always using our evidence to try and pressure the government, to try and help the government, to try and help it get to grips with this problem. And finally, we had a president and a minister who wanted to do something. So the logging in Papua reduced dramatically. The price of merbau has more than doubled in China. There's a big shortage of merbau in the international market. So you can see how this industry was being driven by cheap, illegal supplies. What we're doing now is we continue to monitor the situation. There's been some mutations. Illegal trade is always looking for new opportunities. So right now, merbau logs are being sawn in Papua and exported a different way. But what we're also doing, which is a key part of AIA's work, is we're trying to build capacity in some of the countries we work in, people there, to protect their forests. So we've been doing some training, people in Papua, giving some simple advice and equipment, because ultimately it's their forests and it's their home, and we're trying to help them protect them against further logging. That's a quick insight into how we worked on legal logging. The legal logging problem is huge, but you can see by focusing on specific areas, we can have some success. You know, I just said that the situation in Papua has changed dramatically in 1 year. So if you ever see these big figures and you feel dwarfed, you've got to look at it and what can you do? How can you change the situation? You've got to work on the ground to do that. We also work on the international level. We work in all these conventions, but ultimately our information, our calling card, comes from getting close to the action on the ground. Just a quick explanation about our work on the ozone layer. The ozone depletion is caused by chemicals people make. CFCs used in refrigeration is the main culprit. There was a deal struck in 1987 by the international community called the Montreal Protocol, which seeks to reduce the use of those chemicals. We got involved in ozone issue in the mid-90s, by which time it was obvious that despite the good intentions of the countries that signed the Montreal Protocol, there was a big illegal trade going on which nobody was getting to grips with. Since that time, we've carried out numerous investigations around the world, Europe, US, India, China. Our approach again has been to infiltrate the smuggling rings. We pose as chemical dealers. We set up fake companies. We seek to get the evidence we need to shut the door on these traders. So these are the sort of chemicals that are being traded. This is CFC-12, shipped from China, seized in Indonesia. So over the years, we've built up unique expertise and knowledge of this, how this trade works. The scams that are used to confuse customs, the companies that are doing this trade, where it's coming from. But rather than talk more about our work on CFCs, rather than talk more about undercover things, it's very difficult to sort of explain from here, I thought I'd show you a quick film, which we released late last year, which is about the illegal trade in CFCs, so you can see for yourself how we do that, if I can master the technology. It's a DVD, yeah? Play?
Play. Matt
does it twice. 拿过来你是正规外贸出口还是哪一种出口？还有哪一种出口？还有很多出口。还有，因为你跟我不好意思是不是啊？大家都就是说啊，在这里。通过个每一个渠道都不一样的渠道在出嘛，就是包括巨化，
我就不敢有问题。
没问题，就既然出的已经都出过来了，
是吧？
都出过来了，而且货代的话，因为我们做了十年的话，货代公关就比较好，应该没问题。
而且就是有时候他就是海关，他就有抽查的，那就是抽到你的，就是像通行一样的概率这样。
但是不会是每票都查。
These Chinese traders are unwittingly revealing their illegal business to EIA undercover investigators. The goods they are discussing smuggling out of China, not weapons or drugs, but CFCs, ozone-depleting chemicals used primarily for refrigeration and air conditioning. The crisis of ozone depletion is very real. The southern ozone hole in autumn 2005 reached 25 million square kilometres, equivalent to the size of North America. And in the spring, record ozone losses occurred over the northern hemisphere. Ozone layer damage causes increased ultraviolet radiation to hit the Earth and has dire implications for human health, causing conditions such as cataracts and skin cancer.This problem has been created by the use of man-made ozone-depleting chemicals. To respond to this threat, the global community came together to create the Montreal Protocol, a landmark environmental agreement which has greatly curbed the production and use of CFCs and other ozone-depleting substances, ODS. China has a long track record of ODS smuggling. By 1998,China had overtaken Russia as the main source of illegal CFCs. In 97 and 98, EIA's undercover investigations revealed a network of Chinese brokers illegally supplying both CFCs and halons to North America and Europe.
Frankly speaking, we are supplying F12 overseas. However, some clients ask us to reduce purity.And make F12 like recycled for the sake of import license. The above is our secret between you and me. Do not leak it out.
They are afraid that maybe if they export too much, it may arouse suspicion.
In the largest ODS smuggling case ever detected in Europe, this German businessman imported over 800 tons.Of ODS from China. As the 1990s drew to a close, Europe and the US witnessed a decline in smuggling, due primarily to improved enforcement and tighter regulations controlling the trade and use of ODS. Yet the unscrupulous Chinese traders soon switched attention to the growing black markets in developing countries, where restrictions on CFC use had just entered into force.All of these seizures had one thing in common.
This chiller is in made in China, which contains CFC gas 12.
So these seem to have come from China.
The risk profile said it's come from China.
This is pure CFC-12 manufactured in China.
With this growing body of evidence, EIA decided to probe further into the murky operations of the Chinese businesses and traders involved in smuggling CFCs.
We set up a dummy company, posing as traders, and then we went and approached a number of companies in China. Now, the heart of the CFC industry is here in Zhejiang province,So the focus of our investigation was this province.
During the investigations, EIA discovered just how willing chemical dealers were to export illegal CFC gases, particularly R12 or CFC12, in contravention of both China's and the Montreal Protocol regulations. In Hangzhou, the main city of Zhejiang,EIA investigators met a company seen advertising CFCs on a trade website.
其实外面给你放一排，就是比如说个1234A的那个纸箱嘛，知道吧？但是我把这个里面再放100个纸箱在里面嘛，你回去以后就把这个纸箱就这样拆开以后套进去就好。我们没关系，我们我因为什么我跟那个海关双姐报关哈，关系都相当好的，我们出去肯定没问题。
Another shocking revelation described to EIA investigators was how the company avoided being caught by China's Environmental Protection Administration for these illegal activities.
因为有的时候查得特别严，有一年12个月，其中有一个月特别严格查的。
只一个月？
对，一个月。
是哪一月？
它不一定的，有的时候变成一月份、两月份、三月份，那不一定的。我们会是他们会告诉我们，我们
那边有人，
就是有人在那边嘛，他会告诉我查得特别严。那么这一个月我们一般来说就不会去接单。
Following the meeting, Hang Zhou Sporland sent a pro forma invoice with all the details of the proposed order, accompanied by a note making it clear that the invoice and bill of lading would be filled out to indicate the shipment was of R134A refrigerant.In the port city of Ningbo, EIA investigators met with Karen Ying, the sales manager of Sino Nuchem Import and Export.
For R12, I think for future, for this year, now I tell you truth, we have no export license for R12. If I export to you R12, we declare the customer with not R12.Or refrigerants, just like 404, or just other blended mixture.
Okay, this works okay for other countries.
Yes,
to,
yes.
Where
now our export to Dubai market. Dubai is a very large market. They can clear the customer, so we can supply the goods to them for other countries. Maybe East Asia, I think it's no problem. Just like in Philippines, we export R12 to their market, just like other refrigerants, not market R12.
Okay, so it's successful?
Yes, successful. No problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be in touch today, later today. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Still raining, yeah?
There's one particular case that's the most shocking of all, really, and it was a gentleman called Joe Coman from Sino Resource in Ningbo, the heart of the CFC trade in Zhejiang. Now, EIA's identified him being involved in illegal activities associated with CFCs as long ago as 1997. We've continually informed the authoritiesAnd still nothing is done about it. He's continues to trade and even his business is expanding.
都是出口到哪里啊？
出口很多地方，像我那边的话，我是毛里求斯啊，还有是那个以色列，因为我那边主要就是出口以色列、南非啊、毛里求斯。
所以你们就很多经验。
对。
EIA called the managing director to confirm this.
Hello.
Hello, is that Mr. Coman?
Yes.I will call back again and confirm to you. My assistant Dora will email you that we confirm again. We confirm again that cylinder is 12 and the outside carton is 134A.
In a later communication, Coman's assistant made clear the offer was for one 20-foot container of R12 in R134A packing. The additional option of having the R12 filled in R134A cylinders to further disguise its contents was also suggested. The company also revealed how they smuggled small cans of R12 into Italy.
And you can still send to them the 12 in the small.
Yes. Yeah. This is 12.
Yeah. But in Italy, I understand there is restrictions for 12.
Yes.
But it's okay. You still.
这种包装呢，到时候是怎么包装？包装就是装在纸箱里啊。箱子箱里。Packed in the box in the carton.
Yeah.
And we can pack the carton in 134A or something.
Oh. Right. Okay.
好啊，我们再联系啊。好，谢谢，不用不用多了，谢谢。
Back in Hangzhou, EIA came across the company T Chemi, another firm with a track record of ODS smuggling.
Right. And if we export this 12, we must use another name. And its name is mixed refrigerant.
EIA investigators were then invited to visit the factory and the filling plant and warehouse facilities to see the operations firsthand. It became clear that the factory was the largest remaining CFC producer in China and one which is supposed to be under strict supervision.
里面是外面外面外面的就是呢给他写一个混合制冷剂的字样啊在这报关呢那个好一点就是海关的外面就海关看的话你看二啊一看就12的话那个必须就是那到时候我开票给你我再开混合制冷剂开给你啊就是你们以前的怎么样运去原来的那张啊原来是
We can't tell the customs
it is 12
We can't tell the
customs 你们20是遇到哪些国家
Sihui Qing of T Chemi also revealed how this method of concealing cylinders, termed double layering, was used to smuggle CFCs into Israel.
This is to Israel.
One, two, twelve.
Yeah.
But with
we don't really know what is the packet in the container.
Yeah.
And as I said, in front of the container we will pack some 22.
Right.
So if the customer wants to test it, so we'll take 12 to test.
Right.
22 to test it.
Yeah.
So then no problem.
Okay.
Our time here in China really has indicated that there's still a major problem of illegal CFCs coming out of China. There's a hub of rogue traders continuing to flout the law and ignore regulations and sending CFCs out to the rest of the world. These are companies that are well known. They've been highlighted before. And the Chinese authorities really need to clamp down on this problem to stop this illegal trade in CFCs once and for all.
It is almost 20 years since the Montreal Protocol was signed, and yet, despite repeated warnings, the illegal trade in CFCs continues to flourish. Effective control mechanisms must be put in place immediately, especially in China, where a host of traders are making a mockery of the rules. It is time to put these smugglers out of business, once and for all, and to give the precious ozone layer the space it needs to recover fully for future generations.
thank you. Thank you very much for a fascinating sort of tour through the world. We've got time for some questions now, so I'm sure there'll be several. We'll maybe take them in rounds of two or three, and then the panel can come back. So the gentleman in the blue shirt.
Hi. I've got two questions. One is on the diplomatic side of CITES and international trade. That relates to India and China, and I know in Nepal, I think they've got a Maoist insurgency now, which can't really help efforts there. So generally, I don't know what sort of cooperation you get from the Indian and Chinese government, but I'd be interested in that. Second question is on Sunsad Chand, who intrigues me, really. You know, this guy's been able to get away with smuggling for God knows how many years, so I'd appreciate an update on that, but also your personal perspective. You know, how has this guy managed to get away with it for so many years when he's been known, you know, like these guys in China, this guy's been known to the government for so many years? Those are my points.
One down the very front.
I'd just simply be interested in knowing how you make a living out of that. Where does the fund come from? Who helps you doing those undercover investigations?
Yep, and how do you go about prioritizing or choosing your issues? Why are you focusing particularly on the tiger, for instance?
Do you want to come back?
Thank you. I'll respond to the questions regarding tigers and Sunsad Chand. Within the context of CITES, of course, tigers and leopards are on Appendix 1. All international trade is prohibited, has been since 1976. And as I mentioned, we are starting to see the first signs of real cooperation between India and China. Whether we've been presenting our information through CITES or directly to decision makers in both the Indian and Chinese government, which we have done, CITES provides a forum where there's additional pressure and leverage from the international community for them to really act. For a short period of time last year, the government of India was in a state of denial about the impact of poaching and trade on its wild tigers. And when we returned from China and Tibet in September 2005 and we presented the images and the information from our investigation, it did really catapult the issue to the forefront of the agenda. The Prime Minister of India started engaging quite seriously in the issue, instructed his ministers to engage in dialogue with China. They've signed a recent MOU for exchanging intelligence on security issues and have now included wildlife crime intelligence as information that can be passed through that mechanism. So CITES in itself is obviously a good forum to bring in that international pressure, but also we do engage directly one-on-one with the relevant government authorities. With regard to Sunsad Chand, he's now been sentenced to 5 years in jail, which is at the moment is the maximum under the Wildlife Protection Act. As to how he had evaded law for so long, it's partly to do with the judicial system. It's enormously slow. It does take 10 or 15 years for cases, not just against Sunsad Chand, but some other serious big-time dealers. Those cases still haven't really gone through the courts. But it's also to do with the capacity of the enforcement authorities in India. Traditionally, it's been the Forest Department who've managed these cases, and they're not qualified or trained to even process the basic information reports that are filed at the beginning of a case, and that's where things can start to break down. One of the things that we've been pushing for is for professionals to get engaged in wildlife crime. And again, the Prime Minister of India has responded to the information and images we brought from Tibet to instruct his government to set up a multi-agency enforcement unit, which will bring together full-time officers from police and customs, the intelligence services, and the Forest Department. So we're looking forward to that actually happening, not just being on paper, and that could make a real difference. I'll pass on
the
other questions.
Yeah, I might just respond to the other questions, but I'd just pick up on something there that's implicit in your question as well, which is the response of government, you know, to what we do. It's quite significant that when Ezra, who's sitting there, who was involved with this last film that you've just seen, he took this film and the subsequent report to the Montreal Protocol in December and presented it to 100 nations there. And one might have expected the Chinese to be extremely defensive and unpleasant about it. In actual fact, I think partly because they had been given some warning and Ezra and Julian had already talked to some of the officials, because what we're trying to do, our appeals are not, our campaigns are not just a matter of trying to make a fuss. We're trying to make a difference. And therefore, you have to think, how can we most effectively make a difference? And to work with government, if we can, we will. And it was interesting that for the first time ever, when this was presented to the Montreal Protocol in the plenary session, the Chinese stood up and responded to the intervention that EIA had made and actually thanked Ezra and Julian, thanked EIA for the work they'd done, and arranged a follow-up meeting to find out what they were going to do about it. So the response was slightly unexpected, and that's something that we will always try to take advantage of. If ultimately our backs are against the wall and you can get no response, then you turn to the public. But one of the reasons why perhaps some of you haven't heard of us is because we are not shout first and do something after. We are working often undercover and then trying to do something positive with the work. The answer to the question, how do you get funded, with great difficulty, because we don't tend to follow the tabloid approach, even though sometimes it would be helpful. We are constantly discussing this, trying to do it better, and Dave Curry, who was one of the founding directors, is probably laughing at this moment, because it's been a constant battle to try and keep EIA funded. The answer is that we have a membership base, and we would be very interested in any of you becoming members, telling your friends about us. Of course, this is part of the process. Membership is very valuable because it gives us technically unrestricted funds, which we have some choice about. Then we go to specific big foundations, trusts, that you probably won't have heard of, but there are a number of trusts out there, often set up by very wealthy people who want to do something good with their money, and they also will fund us. But getting those funds takes quite a lot of trouble. You have to have a very clear ask, and you have to maintain a constant relationship with those people. And then the third method is through statutory funding, which is the people, bodies like the EU and even the British government. And EU funding, we have a lot of the forests campaign is now funded by EU funding. And the problem with that is it's good money, but it's very hard to get it, and it's extremely hard to keep it, because the process of managing the funds is very complicated. You have to have extremely transparent budgeting systems and accounting systems, which we're fine with, but they're very expensive. And there's another problem, and that is that they tend to give you a certain amount of money up front, but withhold sometimes up to 20% of the final amount until you finish the job. And the difficulty for an organization like EIA is that we don't have the money to fund the deficits. So we have a lot of problems with money. But we're still there. We've been going for 21 years. And, I mean, we've been running on empty most of the time. And I joined EIA. I could have done lots of things with my life, but I joined EIA because I've been in mixing with them over the years as I've been making my television films. And the people who were staying in the poor hotels and were always getting something done were always EIA. And there are other unmentionables that I always met in the smart hotels, and they were always drinking. So to me, it was absolutely no contest.
back there.
There was another question. How do you prioritise?
Yes, I'll just take that. How we prioritise? That's a very complicated question, because to some extent things lead on from previous. You tend to take a big issue. Tigers was an obvious issue, and forests began with orangutans, and then we realised that there's more to forest. You know, the orangutan question takes you into the forest question. We do not prioritise on the basis of where we can find money. We have these running campaigns which have been important, and often they may be things that we already have expertise in or that we already feel is important. However, what we're not free to do is to take blue sky thinking and simply sit back and say, well, how shall we spend our 5 million this year? We don't have 5 million, we don't have anything like that, and we have very little freedom to move. So we have to be very imaginative in the way we prioritize. And our number one priority is what I said right at the beginning, potency of the impact of closely gathered information. So we need to operate in an area where we know there's criminality and where we know we can get the information and use that information, because it can't be argued with. The things you've seen tonight are things that, you know, even the Chinese government, bless them, just say mea culpa, because it's there, the facts are there. So we prioritise, to some extent, what's really important. Number two, what can we do? We are quite small. We have to choose something that we can actually manage. And that's why we've been successful, because we've picked specific things and gone after them. Not forests all over the world. Merbau, Ramin, look at particular things. And from an instance, you can create a world.
There's a question at the back there, and then...
You've highlighted the actions of single traders and like the logging and in the CFC trade. How about the role of multinational companies? Where do they fit in the formula? And the second part of the question relates, if there's a supply side of timber and of CFCs, the demand is in the other countries like Italy or Israel. How have you been tackling the demand side of these illegal trades?
That's quite a complex question. Maybe we should take that first. Julian, do you want to have a crack at it?
Sure. Yeah, you've seen individuals in those films. Obviously, what we try and do is we try and get the whole picture of these trades. So a lot of our work does involve corporations that are behind it. On the CFC issue, for example, we've been quite robust in exposing companies in Europe that still make CFCs, including some quite well-known companies. I won't state here right now. Sure. Okay, so on that issue, we do try and expose the role of big corporations. On the timber issue, we've been working hard to show how the importers of these products, the timber companies that import these products, furniture manufacturers in the EU and the US, are involved in this trade. And the work we did on Merbau involved naming companies in North America, for example, that were buying Merbau from China. So that is a part of our work. But what we specialize in, I suppose, is getting close to the people who are doing this trade in the clandestine way. There are other groups also working at a corporate level, doing actions against corporations. I mean, Greenpeace and others, they will target companies, and they're very effective at that. We try to expose companies, but our key speciality is looking at how the illicit trade works, and that obviously involves getting close to individuals who are doing that trade. And there was a second question, which was about, yes, demand and supply. Of course, in all our work, we are always seeking to expose the consumer's role in all this, whether it be timber, tiger skins, or chemicals. There are always consumers. So our work on that subject is vital. And again, we've had some successes there with CFCs. We lobbied hard on the European Union to stop using CFCs. That came about in 2001. And we did our report in 1997, which showed a lot of illegal imports into the EU. And so we lobbied the European Parliament, and subsequently CFCs were banned in Europe. So that's an example of trying to take out the demand in Europe. The timber issue, one of my colleagues has worked tirelessly for the last few years to lobby the European Union again to put in place regulations to control the imports of illegal timber. And last year, a regulation was agreed by the member states of the EU, a landmark regulation. First time ever a consuming bloc or a consuming nation has accepted responsibility for driving illegal logging in producer countries. These things are never perfect, but it's a process we're working with now to try and shut the door in Europe to imports of illegal timber. So that's a good point, and we do highlight the driving factors of consumption of all these materials.
And there's an important rider to that, and that is that, for instance, in Indonesia, we work with a partner NGO that is an Indonesian one called Telepak. And one of the things that the forests campaign has been doing is bringing Indonesian representatives over to meet the EU people involved so that they can actually not only hear from us what the problems are, but actually hear from people on the ground what the problems are. And I think that's been quite persuasive. And they've been quite surprised to be talked to by Indonesians saying, you know, this market that you're driving is driving the destruction of our forests. So that's been quite effective.
Sorry, there was a...
Have you ever done any work on climate change? And if not, sort of as Kyoto comes into effect, what scope do you see for work in that issue?
Taking the one at the gentleman at the front and then just behind.
You mentioned earlier the prosecution of a person. I can't remember how long you said it could be prosecuted for, but obviously you implied that it wasn't for long enough. What work can be done to actually make these prosecutions more meaningful so that they're more meaningful deterrents and more likely that people won't try to commit these crimes if they feel they're really going to suffer the consequences? That's the one point. The other is the CITES conventions. Are they really effective? Because we seem to have a terrible situation still with regard to the orangutan or the panda, the whales, like it's coming back up as if all this supposed scientific experimentation is going to be allowed. So what is the actual prospect for extension of species? And, of course, what's the prospect for the retention of the tropical forests? You mentioned Papua, but is that the only one really that can be saved?
Thanks. There was one more, I think, in the front, was there?
Hi there. Thanks for your presentation. My question can probably be best split into two parts. One thing was that I've noticed that the ivory trade and the bushmeat trade and logging and all these other problems have common sources in the sense of poverty, lack of education. And the problem is that most of the time it's only the poor that get caught, because the poor are the people that actually go out and they get paid to actually go and kill these animals, and they bring them back in and then they secretly trade it. So the actual guys at the top never get caught. The second thing I wanted to ask is that, do you only focus on keystone species such as the rhino, the tiger? What about the smaller ones, the ones that are not that easily visible? But, you know, they are a big problem. And considering the fact that we have so much biodiversity, but we haven't explored half of it and we don't know what's out there. I mean, are you working with other NGOs and trying to discover other species that might be at greater threat? Thanks.
On climate change, we don't do climate change at the moment. We didn't do the Montreal Protocol until the mid-90s. The Montreal Protocol was signed in 87. And what we try and do is make sure that these agreements are enforced. So the Montreal Protocol set rules for the trade in CFCs. 5 years, 6 years later, they weren't being enforced, they were being broken. That's where we come in. So maybe down the line, if Kyoto becomes effective and there's trading systems and we find out they're not working properly, then we might get involved.
I'll take the question on Sansar Chand, I think was the individual you were referring to, who's recently been prosecuted in India for wildlife trade. And one of the problems is, of course, the fact that there is very little deterrent in the law. The penalties are very low financially or in terms of prison sentence. And, of course, around the world it varies. And in India, again, the new Prime Minister of India has taken an active interest in the issue, and the Wildlife Protection Act is being reviewed to amend it to increase those penalties. So again, by increasing awareness of the scale of the trade, how severe a threat it poses to whether it's tigers or other endangered species, India is starting to make a move to address those imbalances. In terms of what... In much the same way, when you're dealing with other forms of crime, it's the state's sovereign right to define its own legislation and constitution. And where you see a problem, where you see a law is not being effective or there's loopholes, then you can target that specifically. And again, in relation to CITES and how effective it is, every party that's a signatory to it is ultimately responsible for implementing it. Some countries do better than others. And there is no, CITES doesn't, as a secretariat, have the authority to impose sanctions against countries who are failing to implement it. It's up to the parties to CITES to make it work. So in that sense, each individual country that's a party needs to be aware of particular problems and needs to work together to address issues of cross-border trade.
I think there's... The next question is about the poor people and also about other species. So the other species basically know we're not really species driven. It's just that tigers are such a big issue that we have tended to follow them. But we don't habitually follow a species issue. If you think about ODS, ozone depleting substances, that's a big global issue. Forests is a big global issue. And we have a cetaceans and an ivory campaign, which cetaceans is very much about maintaining the IWC ban on commercial whaling. Ivory something that's under review, but the reason we have ivory is because it was one of the first big things that EIA worked on at the beginning. And EIA was instrumental in bringing in the ban on ivory trading. So it's one of those things that's been our remit. And we really are limited by resources. We simply, everything you said is perfectly correct, but we simply cannot take on all the world's problems. We have to take on certain things and try and do something positive with each of those. Over the poor man issue, you're right. But actually, if you think about everything you've seen tonight, it's all been targeting wealthy people. That's not because we deliberately target them, but what we're doing is tracing the trade up, and where the big levels of criminality occur is where we tend to focus. So the ozone-depleting substances, that's not poor people. That's millions of dollars there, millions of dollars in illegal trade of wood. And the big players are the people that we're trying to focus on. And also with the whole point about Sansar Chand has been to try and get the Indian government to understand that we're talking about big time multinational mafia style organized crime. We're not talking about little guys in the forests who go out and catch something. Obviously that's a problem because they're part of the thread. But our concern is precisely with people like Sansar Chand and all the way through. And these are wealthy people, the very nice people in Tibet who are wearing these and buying these tiger skins. And they are nice people. Actually, it's something we haven't discussed, the complication, the political complication of having to deal with that. nice people who are very wealthy. I mean, those photographs show you, it looks like the gathering of the Country Landowners Association with all their four-wheel drive vehicles and their horses and so on. So we target crime rather than any particular stratum of society, but inevitably we tend to be targeting up rather than down. As far as Forest is concerned, the same thing is true. No, Papua is not the only last tiny little place that forests are worth saving. We tend to concentrate on Indonesia because it's a very large area of the market, and it's an area where we have developed expertise. If we start trying to save forests everywhere, we will end up saving it nowhere. And what we're trying to do is to build up clear case histories that then can be... If you knew a lot about the way NGOs work, you would know that an awful lot of NGOs come in on the back of EIA, and they use EIA's work usually to raise money for themselves and also sometimes to do other work elsewhere. But it has been, we have been one a pioneering organization in that respect, and we've done so by focusing on specifics rather than trying to do everything. And it is a morale problem. I mean, we do sit sometimes and feel the world is falling to pieces and we're only doing a tiny thing. But it's very important to realize that one tiny thing can make a difference, and it really does. And we're talking about CITES. CITES isn't a law enforcement agency with marshals and sheriffs and people who shoot you if you trade. It's a convention. It's a treaty. It's a treaty that has to be enforced by individual countries according to their laws. But what has changed is attitudes. And I was rereading Gorillas in the Mist just this week. And she's talking about, Diane Fossey, talking about the authorities coming in with a request from Cologne Zoo, who wanted some baby gorillas. So the authorities asked her to go out and get some baby gorillas. And she said, but, you know, we can't do that. These animals are protected. You've set up a whole national park here for them. They're terribly rare. There's only 400 or 500 left. And so what did they do? They went to the poachers, and they got the poachers to go in and get the baby gorillas. And that entailed killing two entire families of gorillas. Now, we're talking about 20 years ago. That Cologne Zoo wouldn't do that now. I'm not saying the problem's been solved. It hasn't. There's still a market. There's still illegal problems going on. But it's not being driven by crassly obvious places like that. There's been a big change in the attitude to zoos, the attitude that zoos show. And there's been a big change in the world. So CITES is an important instrument. But it's a bit like the United Nations, you know. It's limited, but it's a lot better than nothing. And it does give us clear areas in which we can operate, clear areas of criminality where the red line comes up and you can follow it. So it has been helpful.
Well, thank you very much to our panelists. Before I formally thank you, I'd like to thank the Environmental Initiatives Network for hosting this talk. And their chair is here at the front. And if you've got any questions for them, you know, please come and speak to Henry during the reception. I'm sure many of you have got many more questions. I know I certainly do. Luckily, we'll have a reception. All of our panelists will be staying around for a while afterwards, so you can come and talk to them individually and ask them questions. So thank you all very much for coming, and thank you once again to our panelists from the EIA.